Don't have enough time to sit down and read all the best Bitcoin articles? Well, let us read them for you. This is a Cryptoconomy Quick Read. What is up, crew? Welcome back to the Cryptoconomy Podcast. I have got, as promised, Lightning Network 2.0 article today. This one is on the Abacus Crypto Journal. This one, if you have not heard the previous episodes with Daniel Goldman, Daniel Goldman is our author here, but we have actually had him on this show. I've read two of his articles in the past. There's a lot of good stuff on the Crypto Abacus Journal. Episode 76, or Crypto Quick Read 76, is the Verge Hack Explained. Quick Read 94 is the follow-up to that. Let's do the time warp again, Verge Hack Part 2. And then our very first crypto chat, number uno, was with Daniel Goldman. And we talked about Verge, digital gold, all the forks, and then, you know, just going... our first trips down the rabbit hole and stuff. We had a really fun discussion. If you want to check those out, I will link to those in the episode, or in the show notes, excuse me. But today we will be hitting his article, which he posted on the 23rd, so like 5 or 6 days ago here, or 4 days ago now. And it is titled, The Lightning Network 2.0, Understanding the Next Wave of Lightning Network Innovations and the obstacles they seek to overcome on the winding road to a scalable Bitcoin. A heads up, this one is rather long, so I think I mentioned in Friday's episode, but we're going to break this into two parts, and today we'll be hitting part one, and we'll head into part two tomorrow. But without further ado, let's begin the article by Daniel Goldman, The Lightning Network 2.0. Lightning, it turns out, travels fast. It's quite a thing to marvel that it's only been a year since Bitcoin's great block limit fiasco of 2017, when it became undeniably clear that the cryptocurrency that was once regularly lauded as being free and instant had become neither of those things. Amidst the frenzied discussions of how to handle this serious PR problem was a sudden resurgence in interest in the Lightning Network, a method for making payments on a second layer on top of the Bitcoin protocol that had first been proposed and outlined in 2015. Last year, the Lightning Network existed only theoretically in white papers, message boards, and the minds of intrepid developers. Skip ahead to today, and the thing is up and running and processing real, no kidding, payments, and even has had a few popular gimmicky applications on it to boot. Now, to be very clear, its current state of roughly 1,500 nodes and 91 Bitcoin of in-network liquidity, as of this writing, is light years away from offering anything like true scaling. It's probably even fair to say it hasn't quite yet approached proof-of-concept territory, but perhaps more noteworthy that the evolving technical implementation has been witnessing the evolution of the surrounding discourse. After the internecine feuding of the great scaling debates literally split the Bitcoin community in two, the group narratives of the two sides suddenly cauterized. Talk to a Bitcoiner and it's a safe bet they'll see Lightning as their inevitable scaling savior. Talk to a Bitcoin casher and it's safe that they'll see block size increase as the only canonical Satoshi-sanctioned way to scale Bitcoin, and Lightning as some sort of non-functional blockstream conspiracy. The level of spite in this debate probably looks ridiculous and insane to crypto outsiders, which may be in part because it is indeed kind of ridiculous and insane. However, to properly understand this debate, one must first understand that it's really a debate about the nature of Bitcoin scaling in general, which is really a debate about the nature of economic value itself, which is really a debate about the future trajectory of human civilization, at which point the elevated passions don't seem quite as out of place. digressions aside, the point is, the resurgence in Lightning Network attention has also meant a concomitant resurgence in debates about viability of the Lightning Network itself. A semi-predictable call and response of claims that the Lightning Network has inherent limitations and rebuttals of how they will be gracefully overcome. Thing is, as these debates rage on, there's a community of developers coming up with new ideas and, you know, actually building stuff. The attention, and let's face it, panic, around finding a scaling solution has led to the Lightning Network community absorbing significant developer mindshare, and there are some pretty powerful innovations being conceived and, in some cases, already rolled out. Thus, much of the back and forth in said debates is outdated, or, if the discussion does acknowledge these new innovations, is bound to come off to newcomers like something of a foreign language. This post attempts to provide a helping hand. I've split the criticisms of Lightning Network into three broad categories. 1. Problems with liquidity between channels. 2. Difficulty obtaining the state of available routes. And 3. Issues associated with the necessity of live nodes. For each of these, I'll be going over some technical proposals that set out to help overcome these obstacles, and I'll provide explanations as to what they do, and technical but hopefully not overly technical explanations of how they actually work. I've also included some thoughts and ideas of my own, because who's going to stop me? While I have no illusions that any of this will help settle the eternal scaling debates, or even remotely decrease animosity among its participants, if this helps to educate, intrigue, and demystify things, so that at least some folks have a better understanding of what it is they're yelling about, I'll chalk it up as a victory. Preliminaries. This post will assume basic knowledge of Bitcoin and blockchain tech. Should a reader be lacking such knowledge and find themselves having trouble following along, many have attempted to give introductory 101 explanations, myself included. Knock yourself out. Links. As for the Lightning Network itself, in the next section, I'll give an overview of what it is, why it matters, and how it works, as succinctly as I can. If the basics of Lightning are already old hat to you, you're encouraged to skip ahead to the Lightning Problem 1 section. What the Lightning Network is, why it matters, and how it works, as succinctly as I can. Lightning. Why? Gold is valuable, but it's also hard to move it around quickly, especially in large quantities. Thus, historically, most gold transactions don't actually involve the physical movement of gold, but rather involve moving something far easier to transport, like paper bonds, which can later be redeemed for gold. This is all well and good, except owning a treasury bond isn't quite as good as owning gold, since now the holder is exposed to the risk of being unable to ever redeem it. Bitcoin, like gold, is, quote, hard to move. Namely, hard in terms of price and speed when it comes to small transactions. Thus, we seek a similar mechanism of trading it without having to, quote, move it on the blockchain itself. However, being the stubborn cypherpunks we are, we seek a way to do this without being exposed to the sort of risk we saw with gold treasury bonds. The Lightning Network makes this possible. So what then exactly are you receiving when you get a Lightning payment? You could think of it as simply receiving Bitcoin. Or you could think of it as a Bitcoin IOU for which the counterparty has no way of shirking their obligation to redeem. Or as a Bitcoin check, which can't possibly bounce. It's hard to find a good analog because it really is a historically unprecedented financial asset. Lightning, how? There are two things to grasp in order to understand how this works. The first is two-party payment channels. In other words, how two parties can send payments to only each other without broadcasting them on the blockchain. The second is connecting a number of these channels together, allowing all members of the network to pay one another. For a two-party channel, the parties, let's adhere to tradition and call them Alice and Bob, deposit an equal amount of funds into a two-of-two multi-sig wallet. which is effectively a joint Bitcoin account in which funds can only be withdrawn with the approval of both parties. We call this the funding transaction. Now, Alice can send Bob a transaction that spins from the funding transaction, effectively updating their balance sheet. Bob could, in theory, broadcast this transaction, or in other words, withdraw his Bitcoin on-chain. But since he can see the funds on the chain and thus knows he has the ability to withdraw them, he doesn't need to actually do so. The couple, I for one, have always assumed Alice and Bob are dating, can proceed like this, sending payments to each other. These are called commitment transactions, never broadcasting any of them, and treating the latest payment as the effective bottom line on their balance sheet. So the big challenge is this. What's to stop Alice or Bob from broadcasting one of their older, outdated payments? Remember, even though Alice and Bob are treating the latest payment as the canonical one, as far as the blockchain is concerned, all of the payments in the channel are equally valid. The answer is this. Remember, these commitment transactions all have two outputs. Some Bitcoin goes to Alice, and some goes to Bob. When Alice settles on the main chain, the Bitcoin that goes to Bob is his immediately. If Alice wants to pay Bob, there's no reason not to allow her to do so. The Bitcoin she's claiming for herself, however, is what we need to be more careful with, and thus, this output is a bit more complicated. The transaction is what's called a hashed time lock transaction, or HTLC. In essence, Alice can only claim the Bitcoin as her own after some allotted period of time, 1 week, say. Time is measured in block confirmations, naturally. During this week-long period, Bob can broadcast a revocation transaction claiming the Bitcoin as his own, providing that in this transaction, he includes a secret. What I didn't tell you is that when this transaction first gets created, Alice generated a secret, hashed it, and included the hash in the transaction. Then when she makes a subsequent transaction, and would thus like to nullify the former one, she shares the secret with Bob, which again gives him the ability to claim it as his own if it ever gets broadcast, as long as he does so within his allotted week. She is effectively giving Bob the ability to punish her if she violates their contract, telling him, quote, "Look, I know you don't know me well enough yet to trust me not to spin this old transaction, so here's the deal. I'll give you this secret so that even if I do try to spend it, you'll catch me doing so. It'll all happen on the public blockchain after all, and you'll have the ability to take all of the money for yourself anyway." End quote. Bob can verify for himself that the secret he was given does indeed grant him revocation, and thus, with this assurance, can accept the latest payment as valid. So now Alice and Bob can pay each other off-chain, which is neat, but not particularly useful, with them being only two people and all. The real goal is to extend this so that any two parties using Lightning channels can potentially pay each other. Begin graphic. So this is just a graphic, it's an illustration of 1, 2, 3, and 4 steps, kind of demonstrating how exactly a transaction is bridged across two channels. It's a little bit hard to explain, so I'm not going to go into it. But if you would like to check that out, just go to the link for the Medium page, because this and other graphics, as we continue on, are really good, and I encourage you to check them out. This graphic was sourced from blog.scottlogic.com, and it's a hash time lock transaction diagram. End graphic. So let's say, for example, Alice wants to pay Claire, with whom she does not have an open payment channel. She does, however, still have her channel opened with Bob, and she notices that Bob has his own channel opened with Claire. The goal is to essentially relay her payment to Claire through Bob. In other words, tell Bob, "I'll pay you, and then you pay Claire." But as usual, this must be accomplished trustlessly. No party should be able to run away with anyone else's money mid-transaction. To achieve this, we use HTLCs again, though this time the process takes a few more steps. First, Claire generates a secret, hashes it, and gives the hash to Alice. Alice then sends Bob an HTLC payment, which Bob can redeem within 1 week or whatever, providing that he has the key. As of now, only Claire has the key, so the transaction is currently worthless to Bob. Bob then sends a similar HTLC to Claire, using the same hash. In other words, Claire can unlock it if she has this key, which, as we know, she does. So if Bob's transaction from Atlas is currently worthless, why is he willing to send a redeemable payment to Claire? Well, Bob knows that if Claire decides to redeem his transaction, she will, by necessity, have to expose her secret on the public blockchain. Bob can then use this secret to redeem his transaction from Alice, so he breaks even. Now, Claire, seeing that she has a redeemable transaction from Bob, is willing to share her secret with him directly. So at this stage, both Bob and Claire are guaranteed redemption of their funds. The only issue is, this whole arrangement is built on ephemeral HTLCs. When they time out, both parties will be forced to broadcast onto the main chain. So to make the off-chain arrangement permanent, now that all funds are secured, Alice can pay Bob directly in their state channel, as described earlier, with a commitment transaction that effectively overwrites the HTLC. Only one, but not both, can be broadcast, so when the HTLC times out, all that will be left will be the commitment transaction. Upon receiving this, Bob does the same for Claire, and at last, we've got ourselves a payment. The example above involved one intermediary relayer, Bob, but in theory, the exact process can be extended to use an arbitrary number of relayers. Since these routers are just forwarding the payments of others, what incentive do they have to get involved at all? Other than an altruistic desire to promote the growth of Lightning and earn good standing among their Bitcoin cohorts, routers like Bob can collect transaction fees. Transaction fees, as with Layer 1 Bitcoin payments, are included by the sender in addition to their payment. With Lightning, each router along the way collects their share. Given the relative ease and low cost of running a Lightning node relative to mining, Lightning fees are assured to be far lower than Layer 1 fees. And that's it. You're officially a Lightning expert. As a nascent expert in the field, you're probably already spotting the technology's various pitfalls, obstacles, and limitations, and wondering what tools and tricks are out there to help overcome them. So without any further ado, the main event. Lightning Problem 1. Liquidity. Perhaps the most oft-levied criticism of the Lightning Network is the problem of liquidity limitations. As described above, payments are made by effectively having intermediaries forward collateral across multiple channels. That means that if our friend Alice wants to pay one Bitcoin to Bob, it isn't enough for Alice to simply find a route of channels between herself and Bob. She must find a route in which each channel hop has at least one Bitcoin available in the direction her payment is to travel. As should go without saying, in a network without a central planner, it's difficult, if not impossible, to anticipate the paths that value will flow and to what extent the liquidity pool will consolidate. This gets thornier when one realizes that money has a way of flowing unidirectionally. My last full-time employer, for example, paid me every 2 weeks, and I don't recall ever sending them a check. I regularly give money to my favorite restaurant, and they have yet to send me any in return, etc. The fear is that payment channels will naturally deplete, thus increasing the odds that if Alice wants to pay Bob, she doesn't actually have a way to do so without opening a new channel or two, which means broadcasting transactions on the chain, and lest we forget that minimizing the amount of transactions that need to be broadcast on the chain was the whole point of this here Layer 2 exercise to begin with. One intriguing retort to this is that the Lightning Network's free market economy will organically sort this out for us. If two Lightning nodes are, quote, far apart, in terms of the minimum number of edges in the network's graph that a payment must traverse to connect them, and a significant amount of capital is traveling between them, routers will be naturally incentivized via routing fee potential to establish more direct paths. And while I can indeed imagine things playing out this way, I for one can also imagine the incentives taking things in the exact opposite direction, namely towards consolidation. The easiest way for me to maximize my access to the network is to connect with a node that already has many channels. Thus, the nodes with the most channels may be natural attractors for even more nodes. I propose that we call them lightning rods. This could lead to a hub-and-spoke topology in which a few select large hubs maintain the majority of channel traffic. Exactly how much of a bummer this hub-and-spoke effect would be is a matter of debate. See here, link included, for the not-actually-as-bad-as-you-think argument. But in any case, most Bitcoiners would probably agree that ideally, we want the network to be as dispersed and distributed as possible. This means coming up with ways to facilitate more flexibility in terms of liquidity flow, channel rebalancing, and the like. Here are some of the ideas that are in the works, in no particular order. Atomic multipath payments. Suppose Dear Alice wants to pay Bob one Bitcoin, but no path exists between Alice and Bob with one Bitcoin staked each step of the way. However, Alice, clever lightning router she is, does find one path where she can send Bob 0.5 Bitcoin, another path for 0.3 Bitcoin, and another for 0.2 Bitcoin. With an atomic multipath payment, Alice can pay Bob by splitting her payment into these three, or more, in theory, parts. Of course, even without any AMP tech, nothing is stopping Alice from making many small payments instead of just one big one. The key feature that allows AMPs to replace a single payment is that there are no, quote, partial payments possible. In other words, either Bob can redeem all three payments or none of them. The payment either clears as a lump sum or it doesn't, as we would reasonably expect a payment to behave. It works like this. Alice starts by constructing a big secret code. Let's say her secret code is Alice's big secret. Note, this is a poorly chosen secret. Using this big secret code, Alice constructs three small secret codes, one for each payment she's going to send, by simply concatenating the numbers 1 through 3 to her big secret, like this. Small secret code 1, Alice's big secret 1. Small secret code 2, Alice's big secret 2. Small secret code 3, Alice's big secret 3. These small secrets are then each hashed, and the hashes are attached to each of the three partial payments, such that Bob needs to know each payment's a small secret in order to claim its funds. Note that the similarity of the small secrets has no effect on the resultant hashes, which look effectively random. As additional data included with each payment, Alice sends, quote, one-third of her big secret, i.e., payment one gets Alice, payment 2 gets as big as, and payment 3 gets ecrit. If Bob does indeed get all three payments, he uses this data to create the big secret code, concatenates the numbers 1, 2, 3 on the end, and presto, he can claim all of his money. If, however, even one payment fails to arrive, say it got lost on the way from a node going offline, or Alice just never even sent it, the scamp, Bob's data is useless in helping him claim any transactions, and the transactions he does receive will simply time out. Note to nitpickers. No, the quote, big secret isn't simply split into thirds and reconcatenated. The partitioning and recombining uses the XOR operation, but the principle is the same. Also, if you're concerned about nodes on the way colluding to share the partial data with each other and crack the secret themselves, note that the, quote, additional data is in an onion-routed blob, so relax. A nice thing about implementing AMPs is that only the payment sender and receiver need to do any additional work. The routers in between them relay the data just as they would with regular Lightning payments, completely none the wiser that anything jazzier is going on. Splicing. In the regular Lightning Network arrangement, henceforth referred to as Vanilla Lightning, the only way funds exit the network back onto the main chain is by closing the channel they sit in, and likewise, the only way funds enter the network is by opening a brand new channel. The ability to alter channel balance in a single transaction would be a nice benefit for network liquidity, as it would mean users could replenish channels as they get depleted, and that they could withdraw only the funds they absolutely need, keeping as much of that precious funding as possible within the network. Splicing opens up the door for this, enabled by an alternative state channel transaction structure called Fund Cask. In this arrangement, funding transactions can take an arbitrary number of inputs and outputs, including, crucially, other funding transactions. So under the hood, quote, splicing in, or adding funds to a channel, simply entails closing out one channel and opening up a new one in a single transaction. This new channel takes as inputs the old channel, and thus the old stack of commitment transactions are invalid, so we don't have to worry about them anymore, along with some other on-chain Bitcoin. The net result being that the two counterparties still have a channel open together, only now the available funds in the channel have increased. Splicing out follows similar logic. A single transaction closes a channel and spends its funds in the form of two new outputs. One output lives outside of the Lightning Network, the other establishes a new channel with the remaining Bitcoin. Just to underscore a point, splicing in and out does require one on-chain transaction, putting an upper bound on how much this technique could and should be relied on. But the key point is that achieving these same results without splicing would require two or more transactions, making splicing a net win for scaling, preserving that sacred block space. Submarine swaps. The idea of submarine swaps is to help bridge the divide between on-chain and off-chain funds with a submarine swap. Alice can pay Bob by sending him an on-chain transaction, which Bob effectively receives as a payment in one of his already existing state channels. Conversely, Bob can pay Alice by sending a Lightning payment that Alice ends up receiving as on-chain Bitcoin. There are a number of potentially valuable use cases for this mechanism, the most obvious being helping Bitcoin through its transition phase to more Lightning adoption, when some, but only some, users have taken to using Lightning. So suppose Alice wants to send Bob some Bitcoin, but since Alice has become a diehard believer in Bitcoin Cash, she refuses to ever set up a Lightning node on principle. Bob is a Bitcoin man who's adamant about accepting all of his payments in Lightning channels. Although their relationship is most likely on hiatus, Alice still wants to pay Bob. But how? What they do is, they find a third party willing to facilitate this transaction. Re-enter Claire. The requirements for Claire here is that she's willing to be the middlewoman. Though a trustless, non-custodial middlewoman. Relax. In Alice and Bob's transaction, and that she has enough funds in the Lightning Network to forward Alice's payment to Bob. The procedure is then similar to that of a regular Lightning Network multi-hop payment, described in Lightning How. Only this time, one side is on-chain. Bob generates a secret, hashes it, and exposes the hash to Alice. Alice now creates an on-chain transaction to Claire that can only be redeemed if Claire has the secret. Claire sends Bob an HTLC payment with the same hash. Recall that to complete the payment, Bob has to reveal the secret to Claire. At this point, Claire can claim her on-chain funds, and Bob has access to his off-chain funds in his channel with Claire. Bob got paid, and Claire breaks even, or comes away slightly ahead via routing fees. If you happen to also already be familiar with atomic swaps, then you can think of submarine swaps as combining vanilla Lightning multi-hop payments and atomic swap mechanisms into one. In fact, since the only requirement for the atomic swap-esque on-chain side of things is an HTLC transaction, submarine swaps could even occur between two different cryptocurrencies, giving us a decentralized mechanism for exchanging assets on the first layer of one chain with assets on the second layer of another, which is neat. Channel factories. All right, and we are about halfway through with this article, so we are going to stop there, and we will start back tomorrow with channel factories as we finish this up with part two of this article. I think we're pretty much halfway through it here, but I think this is a really good spot to stop. I love going into all the, if you don't follow Alex Bosworth in particular, he has so much work going on with submarine swaps and splicing and atomic swaps between different chains. He has updates very regularly, and he posts it all on Twitter. So I definitely encourage you to check him out. But this actually is a really good, simple explanation, I think, and I hope it comes across in audio. I know it's so hard to imagine these relationships like visually when you're reading it or listening to it. I think this does a really good job of explaining why it is that none of these things are trusted relationships. These are not, there are third parties, quote unquote, there are middlemen between these transactions that are routing the payments, but they are not trusted third parties. They're not security holes. They are service providers that do not introduce counterparty risk. And this is done through, it's funny, almost all of these tools and little mechanisms that they have are pretty much a combination of hash time lock contracts. You selectively share secrets with the people that you're paying, and you hand out a lock to everybody that's routing the payment along the way, and not until the person at the end reveals the secret, unlocking the coins sent to them, does everybody else get to unlock their coins. But it's locked all the way along the entire path, so nobody has to worry whether or not they're going to get their coins. And the only thing that somebody can do to lose coins in the middle of a route is to let the thing expire, let the HTLC expire, without ever redeeming it. But there's no reason they would never have the secret, as the blockchain is public. And whether it's an atomic swap, a submarine swap, a splicing, I guess the splicing technically does not work that way, or just a normal payment routed through the Lightning Network, or an atomic multipath payment, regardless, if the person at the end reveals the secret is publicly visible on the blockchain. So the people in the middle, the people routing the payments, or the nodes routing the payments, have no control over the payment. All they are given is a lock and the payment amount. And that's it. The secrets are held and shared between the payer and the payee. Either way, I just thought this was a really good article to kind of start digging into this, and he does such a good job going over. There's so many other little tools and stuff that he goes into, and Channel Factories is particularly lengthy, and it's really complicated. I had a really hard time wrapping my head around these myself, so I want time to go through that one in depth, and also talk about it quite a bit in the commentary afterward. So we will save that all for tomorrow and start back with part two of the Lightning Network 2.0 at Channel Factories. All right, guys, don't forget to check out Daniel Goldman and the Abacus Crypto Journal. There is just a ton of great stuff up there. I've been enjoying David Boehner's Crypto Around the World issues. He's got three of those, and it's kind of just talking about what's happening with crypto around the world. Adoption and new developments and all that good stuff. So definitely check out all the stuff they got going on at the Abacus Crypto Journal. And Daniel Goldman actually had another one recently called The Crypto Classics. And it's a short list of really classic and like need to hear or need to read writing in the crypto space. So definitely encourage you to check those out. And I've already read a couple of those in the podcast. And I will probably be reading a number of the other ones as well. I just need official permission for those. So with that, though, don't forget to follow me as well at The Crypto Economy on Twitter. You can find the link to Mastodon right there in my description, and on Medium as well. I got a lot of stuff coming out pretty soon. I hopefully will have a pretty big announcement at the end of this week, I hope. It's looking like we're on schedule for it. And hopefully got some more interviews right around the corner. Been having some scheduling problems, but crypto chats aren't gone. I know I've had a little bit of a gap with those. But follow me on Twitter and subscribe to the podcast to make sure you stay up to date on all of that, and I'll keep you guys informed. And if you would like to support the show or help out in any way, the best way to help are leave me a review and share it, share the podcast with people in the crypto space and, you know, Bitcoin, fellow Bitcoin maximalists. And also I will have my donation address available. You can always donate if you'd like to help me stay funded and keep this thing alive as long as possible. That is a huge help. Thank you so much. And I have my affiliate link for the Trezor store. If you would like your crypto hardware wallet, like to update to the new cool one with the color screen, or just want any little accessories and, you know, cases and stuff for it, use my affiliate link, and none of it will cost you anything, but you'll throw a couple of bucks my way to help out the Crypto Economy Podcast. All right, guys, we will close that here. Thank you so much for listening. Don't miss part two tomorrow, and I'll talk to you then. Take it easy, guys.